Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 10th of July. Today, as prosecutors review evidence of phone tapping by the News of the World, The Guardian reveals that Alan Shearer and Sir Alex Ferguson were among those whose messages were intercepted by the paper.
It's clear from evidence that we've seen from the Information Commissioner that it's a practice that was widespread and not just limited to the News of the World.
Vanessa Feltz gives her reaction to the news that her phone was tapped.
I come out of somewhere utterly innocuous, and there'd be a paparazzi waiting for me, and I would be thinking, how on earth could anyone possibly have known I was going to be there?
And in other news, we hear from the loved ones of soldiers risking their lives in Afghanistan.
It's hard. It really is a hard place to have a son at the moment serving.
But first, here's Bill Overton with today's news and the papers.
Football managers Alex Ferguson and Alan Shearer were among those whose phone messages were recorded by a private investigator working for the News of the World. The revelations come as other public figures are believed to be considering legal action against the paper over hacking claims. Meanwhile, David Cameron's insisted his Director of Communications, Andy Coulson, will not be forced out over the allegations. Coulson resigned as editor of the News of the World in 2007 after one of the paper's journalists was jailed for phone hacking, but he maintains he never knew about the underhand technique that led to several of the paper's exclusive stories. More on this to come in Guardian Daily. A teacher in Nottinghamshire has been arrested on suspicion of the attempted murder of one of his pupils. Peter Harvey of the All Saints Roman Catholic School in Mansfield was detained after a boy of 14 was left with serious head injuries after apparently being struck with a weight. Britain's nuclear weapons stockpile could be reduced after a summit to be organised by Barack Obama next year. The talks are likely to involve up to 30 countries, with the aim being to reduce the numbers of nuclear weapons in a disarmament process started by Washington and Moscow. A US commander has warned the expected victory of Hamid Karzai in next month's Afghan presidential elections could trigger violent protests. Although the Taliban have threatened to disrupt the polling day, Colonel David Haight says he's far more concerned about the aftermath of the election. Meanwhile, the mother of a soldier killed in a snatched Land Rover in Iraq will launch a legal challenge today against the Ministry of Defence. The government has refused to hold a public inquiry into the continued use of the controversial light armoured vehicles. Sport now, and on day two of the first Ashes test in Cardiff, Australia fought back with two players making centuries. The Guardian's Mike Selvey was there.
It was a very good day for Australia. They came back very strongly. Ricky Ponting, just a majestic innings, 100, reaching his century off the penultimate ball of the day. Cadditch, 104, not out. The first person, of course, to get a century on this newest of test grounds. And they really have put Australia right back in the frame. There's still 186 runs adrift of England's first innings, but 9 wickets in hand, and the pitch playing a little easier than I think we all thought it might do. They're very much back in the frame.
Mike Selvey reporting. Now for a look at today's papers, and the Times warns the NHS isn't ready to deal with an epidemic of swine flu. It's seen a leaked memo that describes the government's emergency plans as muddled. The news that Britain's swine flu deaths have doubled makes the front page of The Express. It puts the total number of confirmed cases at nearly 10,000, although The Telegraph claims it's only 8,000. The Guardian continues its expose of illegal phone hacking at the News of the World. The FT, in return, calls for British journalism to raise its standards. The Sun reports code breakers who worked at Bletchley Park during World War II are to be officially recognised with a commemorative badge. What took them so long? That's the real enigma, the paper's editorial asks. And the Mail pictures two young soldiers who were struck in a Taliban rocket attack. They joined up together, the paper says, and today one lies wounded. The other is coming home in a coffin. On the back pages, there's criticism for Gareth Barry, one of Manchester City's recent big money buys. Liverpool boss Rafa Benitez accuses him of greed after the midfielder turned down a move to Merseyside. More news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Sir Alex Ferguson and Alan Shearer are among those whose messages were intercepted by the News of the World. Both had contact with Gordon Taylor, the chief executive of the Professional Footballers Association. He received £700,000 in an out-of-court payment from News Group, Rupert Murdoch's company, which owns the News of the World. It paid a total of £1 million to settle legal cases that could have revealed how his journalists broke the law to get stories. The Crown Prosecution Service is examining its evidence of phone tapping, and there are also renewed inquiries by MPs on the Commons Select Committee and the Press Complaints Commission. But the police aren't going to reopen their investigation. The Met's Assistant Commissioner John Yates insisted no new evidence had come to light.
This case has been the subject of the most careful investigation by very experienced detectives. It has also been scrutinised in detail by both the CPS and leading counsel. They have carefully examined all the evidence and prepared indictments that they considered appropriate. No additional evidence has come to light since this case has concluded. I therefore consider that no further investigation is required.
The News of the World used private investigators to illegally hack into the mobile phone messages of public figures, including the broadcaster Vanessa Feltz.
I'm absolutely horrified. It's the most extraordinary feeling. I mean, you suddenly, your mind starts racing with, you know, what on earth have you been texting people? What have they texted you? And these bizarre occasions in my life, which I now recall with sort of dazzling clarity, where I'd come out of somewhere utterly innocuous and there'd be a paparazzi waiting for me. And I would be thinking, how on earth could anyone possibly have known I was going to be there? Even I didn't know till, you know, 40 minutes before the event when I got a text from a mate or something like that. And also you think, my goodness, personal private things that pertain to me and also to other people, whether they're famous or whether they're not famous. For example, my own children. You know, I'm a single mum of two. During the year 2006, one of my daughters was in hospital. I remember coming out of the hospital, in fact, kind of in the foyer of the hospital, bumping right into a reporter. Now, how on earth would a reporter know something like that when I hadn't told anyone? I'd run straight there, you know, on receipt of a text from my child. And you kind of think, my goodness, I mean, fortunately, I'm not in possession of any international secrets. I don't know anything about MI6 or espionage or Iraq or Afghanistan or anything else. But I am a private human being. I'm not in receipt of any public money or any public funds. And I feel very much that I'm entitled to make private personal phone calls just like anybody else without the newspapers tapping into them. I feel there should be some kind of full disclosure about what exactly has gone on. Who do I think should be accountable for this, or who should be held responsible? Well, I imagine it should be whoever was editing the paper at the time and also the management of the paper at the time, including the proprietor of the paper, in that they must be responsible for engendering such an ethos and allowing such behaviour to flourish, because in a newspaper which is respectably, responsibly and legally run, that kind of behaviour surely couldn't possibly be countenanced. I have already made a call to my lawyer to seek legal advice on this. I mean, I'm not quite sure how one would proceed, but it strikes me that this can't be a legal way to treat another citizen.
Vanessa Feltz. Well, it wasn't just celebrities who the News of the World had under surveillance. Tony Harding is a Doncaster painter and decorator. His mobile number was obtained by the paper.
Very shocked. I thought it was a bit of a joke at first, but now I've listened to the story, yes, seems quite, it could have happened, yeah.
And I was, you know, I was just vaguely at the back of my mind, I thought, you know, maybe this is South Yorkshire's criminal mastermind, but that's not what you do.
No, I'm a painter and decorator, down-to-earth bloke, that's basically me.
We were sitting here trying to think what it could possibly be about.
I come home from work one day and my landlord, Martin, said to me that there was two CID officers that would like to have a word with me about something. They got in touch with me by my phone number at the time, which I was using, and they told me they were the regional crime squad and they would like to take some surveillance equipment into my attic and take some pictures of a funeral that was happening. And they wanted all afternoon and asked me to not to be there while it happened. And basically I declined.
There's that kind of possible explanation for what otherwise seems the most extraordinary event. But the upshot of it is, Tony, is that you're... unbeknown to you, your privacy was being invaded.
Yes, invaded, and I feel quite strongly about that now I've been explained to everything, and I'd like to find out what they intend to do about it.
Tony Harding talking to Martin Wainwright. Well, the Conservative Party leader, David Cameron, has defended his Director of Communications, Andy Coulson, who resigned as editor of the News of the World over the phone hacking. In our Westminster office, commentator Michael White says the Tory leadership breathed a sigh of relief at the news yesterday that there'd been no new police inquiry.
Yes, Mr. Yates said, in effect, we've got no new evidence, we investigated it properly last time. There wasn't enough evidence to prosecute other cases last time, and we did the right thing, so we're not going to reopen the case. Well, that may be a holding position. It may change in the light of other information which comes out one way or the other, or it may turn out to be right on the money. We'll have to see. It's a fast-moving situation.
We do know, irrespective of the Guardian's report this week, that phone tapping did happen on Andy Coulson's watch when he was editor of the News of the World. Do questions remain about David Cameron's judgment in appointing Andy Coulson?
Well, David Cameron has been quite firm on this tonight. Again, rightly or wrongly, my instinct all day has been that Coulson would have to go, that we've been through these long, dragged-out battles before. But Cameron says no. We knew what he did last time. He didn't know anything about the royal reporter who went to jail. He was just a rogue operative who was having this deal with a private detective to tap into those phones. And nonetheless, Andy Coulson resigned as editor of the News of the World. He took the blame. He took responsibility. Good for him. And I'm standing by him. Cameron's officials have been around the press gallery here at Westminster today saying very emphatically that that's David's position, and they're going to stick by it. And we've been saying, are you quite sure about this? Don't you think you ought to let yourself a bit of wriggle room? Anyway, they won't, and we'll see who's right.
Michael White in Westminster. Well, The Guardian revealed that the practice of phone tapping was more widespread than had been thought. Matt Wells is presenter of our Media Talk podcast.
I think it's a practice that is widespread, has been widespread in the tabloid newspaper industry, even in the mid-market, and some of the qualities as well. Whatever the police said yesterday, it's clear from evidence that we've seen from the Information Commissioner that it's a practice that was widespread and not just limited to the News of the World. I mean, I talked yesterday to a couple of agents who represent well-known figures, and they said, you know, we all knew it was going on. It's just we never have had the evidence to pin it down. And we have to remember that the News of the World, News Group newspapers have not denied paying out nearly £1 million in to settle three separate cases out of court with gagging clauses in order that the evidence wouldn't come out.
The Press Complaints Commission didn't interview Andy Coulson in its original 2007 investigation. The inquiry was widely criticised at the time. They might reopen it, but can you just remind us what happened back in 2007?
Yeah, there was an investigation into subterfuge in journalism in 2007 when the first allegations were raised involving Clive Goodman, the former royal editor of the News of the World, and a private investigator who he was using called Glenn Mulcair. Both of them, incidentally, ended up in jail. It was thought at the time that this could be a practice, as I was saying, that was more widespread and there might be evidence of it, and the PCC agreed to investigate. What happened was that Andy Coulson, who was then the editor of the News of the World, resigned. And because he resigned, the PCC said that they wouldn't call him because he was now not the editor of the News of the World. He didn't fall under their jurisdiction, which, quite frankly, was a rather laughable defence. And it was that action, I think, more than any other, which coloured people's reaction to the investigation, which did come up with a number of recommendations, and it tightened up the PCC code of conduct. But I think the fact that they wriggled out of interviewing Coulson didn't lend the resulting investigation much credibility at all. Now, after The Guardian published these latest allegations yesterday, the PCC said it would be requesting information from both the police and The Guardian and would take a view as to whether to reopen the investigation. It said it took a dim view of the practices involved. The trouble is, though, is that there's just a general perception that the PCC isn't up to this kind of complicated and complex investigation. If you talk to broadcasters, who are heavily regulated by Ofcom, they point to Ofcom, which is a huge organisation with hundreds of members of staff, who have a big, thick code of practice and lots of rules that everyone has to abide by. And broadcasters point out that the press would be outraged if Ofcom took a similar approach to the PCC to broadcasters. Just look at the furore over the Russell Brand and Jonathan Ross affair. If it was a light touch PCC style regulation of that, they would be uproar in the press. So I think there's a feeling really that the Press Complaints Commission, in the grand scheme of things, really isn't up to this kind of investigation.
Matt Wells, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/media. Also on The Guardian's website, Patrick Barkham goes, armed with a radar gun, to some of the places where a 20-mile-an-hour speed limit has been imposed and wants to find out if people are obeying the law. guardian.co.uk/G2. The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter Simon Hoggart appeared before a select committee yesterday, and Steve Pound, the MP for Ealing North, gives his assessment of Hoggart's performance. guardian.co.uk/politics. And the Pompidou Centre in Paris is displaying the largest collection of art created by women ever exhibited together in one show. That's guardian.co.uk/arts. I'm John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, a new exhibition of Van Gogh's paintings and his correspondence.
There's one terrible letter in which he's just had a hot meal and he thinks about it and says he doesn't think he's had six hot meals in the last 4 or 5 years, because obviously, you know, bread and cheese was always cheaper for artists.
But first, British troops in Afghanistan have had a terrible week, particularly the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards. Their commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornelow, was killed by an explosion in Helmand Province last week. And 4 days later, another Bridgend man, Lance Corporal Dane Elson, was killed in another explosion. Well, the Welsh Guards recruits from Bridgend in South Wales, and the Guardian's Stephen Morris went there to meet some of the relatives left behind. In April, Kelly Gore lost her partner, Lance Sergeant Toby Fasfus. He died during a patrol with the Afghan army.
These two big photos in the frame here, this one was when he was a sniper in Iraq. And, you know, he loved it. But he always wanted to go and be in the mortars, so that's what he did. He did the course. I think he finished it in back in August. He completed the mortar course, which is where he lived. You know, he was happy.
And in the centre there you've got...
I bought that for Toby, Welsh Guard, before he went to Afghan.
It's a Welsh Guard teddy bear, yeah, I should explain.
That's right. And he wouldn't take it with him because he reckoned that he had too much stuff. But I think he was just a bit embarrassed because he has a teddy and he's a big old hard man. So, and this one here then is Christmas time. The sergeant's mess do, all dressed up in his mesh dress. It was medal, so it was, you know, it was a good night. Someone said, "Oh, you're starting to make a shrine for Toby," but without realising, I suppose it is getting a bit like it.
It must be so hard. It's not just Ted. There's lots of Bridgend lads out there, and there's one or two that aren't coming back as well. That must be hard for the whole community.
Oh yeah, completely. You know, we've been there's these bands the Welsh Guards have got, these green and white ones, support the Welsh Guards in Afghan, and people are noticing them and asking, where'd you get those from? And we've had 100 and sold those, like, straight away. People are becoming more aware, definitely. People are starting to notice more, I think, because they see it on the news more, and like you said, it's a small community, Bridgend is, and they are our local lads. And like these guys that are dying after Toby, you know, you can empathise with them because you know when that guy knocks on your door, that is just the worst day of your life.
So what do you think of the cause? Should these lads be out there?
If the government keep them there and good is being done, they do get Afghan back on their feet and there is, you know, civilization there again, then, yeah, they, you know, they've done a good job and these boys died for a good cause. But if the government in 2 years or whatever just turns around and pulls out and nothing has changed and the Taliban are still there, have got a hold on the country, then I think then these lives have been wasted.
My name is Mrs. Deborah Davis.
And you're the mother of?
Lance Corporal Damien Crombie, serving with the 1st Battalion, the Welsh Guards, in Afghan.
He's out there at the moment?
Yes, Damien's out there.
Can I ask what it's like having a week like you've had, just where we've had so many lads losing their lives out there?
It's hard. It really is a hard place to have a son at the moment serving. And I'm not the only parent like it. There's 600 other Welsh Guards families that are in the same position as me. I believe in the armed forces, and I believe in the job that our soldiers do. If we weren't there, if these boys were not there, these people, they would have no quality of life. Their complete rights would be taken away from them. If we allow this not to be nipped now in the bud, I feel that we will have a greater war to fight in the future. It is really sad, the amount of life that's taken at the minute, and it is a constant fear that not could be out. But I do really believe in the job that my son does.
Stephen Morris reporting.
I feel a power in me which I must develop. a fire that I may not quench, but must keep ablaze, though I do not know to what end it will lead me, and shouldn't be surprised if it were a gloomy one.
They're the words of the artist Vincent van Gogh in a letter to his brother Theo on the 5th of November 1882. And it's a rare chance to see dozens of van Gogh's letters, some of which contain sketches of his most famous paintings, in a major exhibition of his work at London's Royal Academy. Maeve Kennedy has the details.
Well, it's a fantastic idea because it's pulling together paintings by Van Gogh, which will include some incredibly familiar and really beloved images, sunflowers and skies with clouds storming like a boiling soup pot and great stars and dark cypress trees and wonderful golden fields, with the letters in which he often describes these exact scenes. And he doesn't just describe them, he writes incredibly well. He puts in little drawings of himself and of the landscape, drawings of the pictures he's working on, and they bring alive his work and the way he was living in the most extraordinarily vivid way. So you'll be able to see the pictures and the letters, and I think see into the mind of Van Gogh in a way you never have before.
Now, the popular image of Van Gogh is a tortured genius with mental health problems.
Miserable old git who chops a bit off his ear and then kills himself.
Well, does the letter support that caricature?
They do to a certain extent. He gets very miserable, but then he's usually writing to Theo, who is funding the whole thing. So he's usually trying to put a fairly good spin on it for Theo, because Theo is the one who keeps sending letters with 50 franc notes, which are what's paying for the absinthe and, more importantly, for the chrome yellow oil paint. So although he certainly admits to having tidal waves of misery, and you can see times when it is really swamping him, more often than that, he's saying, I'm going out to look at this. I saw a beautiful sunset. I looked at this wonderful field. I was tramping around looking at the boats. And of course, if you look at the date, sometimes you can see this must be a man who's leading quite a lonely life, because sometimes the letters are coming at the rate of two or three a day. He writes to Theo almost every day unless they're together. So one way or another, this man has quite a lot of time on his hands by himself. They're often written in miserable, dirty little lodging houses or on cafe tables, and some of the letters have marks of you know, wine glasses, absinthe glasses, very small meals. There's one terrible letter in which he's just had a hot meal and he thinks about it and says he doesn't think he's had six hot meals in the last 4 or 5 years. Because obviously, you know, bread and cheese was always cheaper for artists than a nice hot meal, and there was nobody at home to cook for him. So it's a wonderful mixture of kind of pathos, humanity, humour, and an extraordinary looking over his shoulder insight into the way he worked.
And the public are going to be able to see these letters, not just in this exhibition, but in a remarkable project by the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam.
It is completely extraordinary. They have drawn together every surviving letter. They're publishing them all online and free with their own fantastic annotations, which go into detail, which is just extraordinary. So every picture of Van Gogh's is reproduced in them. Every picture by anybody else that he refers to is reproduced. Every person that he mentions is traced. Every historical incident that he mentions is traced. They'll be free online. They're also being published in the most magnificent, sort of heroically old-fashioned publication venture. They'll be published in 6 hardback volumes in a slipcase. And the English price will be £325, which is a fairly heroic price for a set of books.
The ideal present for Christmas stockings everywhere.
It's on my list already.
Maeve Kennedy and The Real Van Gogh, the Artist and His Letters, runs at the Royal Academy in London from the 23rd of January until the 18th of April next year. Adam Gabbett and Phil Maynard produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.